Good morning. If you want to open your Bible up to Judges 17, we'll begin our study there in a few minutes. Steve's out, so I'm filling in his absence, but we're not going to continue the study on self-esteem. We're going to look at just the last five chapters of Judges this morning. And before we begin our class, I've asked Wally to lead us in a word of prayer. You can put a marker if you want somewhere from Judges 17 through 21. Obviously, we're not going to read all that or even look at much of it. If you had a chance to look over it before today, that's great. If not, then that's fine too. You won't be too much of a loss. Obviously, it's not fun reading if you're familiar with it. This is one of the nastiest moments in all of Israel's history. I want to start off by looking at a statement that is made in Judges chapter 19. In verse 30, all who saw it said, "Nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from the day when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day." Just take that sentence by itself and isolate the first half of it. Nothing like this has ever happened or been seen. At any point in the last, say, 2 years, have you turned on the TV set and found yourself thinking that very thing? For me, it was Monday, October 2nd, that morning when I woke up and I heard about the 58 people that had been murdered in Las Vegas. That really took me back. We've had a lot of mass shootings, but the death toll hasn't been as high as that one. Just something about it, I guess the numbers got to me, the horror stories that were coming in from people that were there or that survived it. We heard later on about a man named Stephen Paddock, the alleged shooter, who was found dead in his hotel room. And we heard about the kind of man that he was, and we heard about his background and some shady things going on in his history. And one person that I periodically read I check a few commentators during the week whenever I feel like it, and one of them was talking about this man, and he may have even titled his article or his column, "The Dead Soul of Stephen Paddock." That really got my attention. He mentioned that Nevada has the death penalty. Obviously, that's where the shooting took place, but that was not enough to deter this man from killing all these people. And he mentioned that it's more than just simply having a fear of death. The man had no fear of hell. And by obvious extension, he had no reverence for God or what God would require of him in the way that he treated his fellow man. That's a pretty valuable lesson, and it's one that we find over and over again, and we especially find it in the last five chapters of the book of Judges. This isn't pleasant reading, but a lot of times we find ourselves having to deal with or contemplate unpleasant things, and we may even relate to how the people reacted in chapter 19 and verse 30. Does anyone know offhand? If you don't, that's fine. We'll talk about it. But anyone can tell me what the cycle of the book of Judges is? In the past, whenever the Bible survey has been taught here, normally it's been distilled into four words that all start with the letter S. Okay? Very good. So it starts off with sin. So the people abandon God. And typically, what is the one sin in particular that the book of Judges tells us about?
Idolatry.
So they start going along with the religions of the people around them, and they worship their idols. That leads to suffering. So what happens when they become idolaters? What inevitably becomes of the people of Israel? Yeah, they get taken over. They're invaded, and then they're oppressed. And then that leads to supplication. Once the people start to hurt, what do? Yeah, hit their knees, they pray to God. And then God saves or delivers them. And in the book of Judges, what is his means of delivering the people?
A judge.
Is this the intended function of a judge, by the way? It's not. The Old Testament, in the book of Deuteronomy, and if you look in Judges chapter 5, I think. Chapter 4. You find, as far as I can tell, the one judge that actually does some real judging between people, and that's Deborah, the prophetess. She's mentioned there in Judges chapter 4 and verse 5. She would sit under a palm tree, and the sons of Israel would come to her for judgment. She's basically the only one that you read about in the whole book that does the work of a judge as it is prescribed in the law of Moses. Everybody else is fighting off an oppressor. The most famous one, of course, is Samson and his wars against the Philistines. But an interesting thing in the book of Judges is that if you start, for example, in chapter 3 and verse 9, you read about the first judge, Othniel. And then you get down to verse 15, you've got the second judge, it's Ehud. Down in verse 31, the third judge, Shamgar. And then you get to chapter 4 and verse 4. You meet the fourth one, Deborah. And of course, she influences a man named Barak to help free the people of Israel. And on and on and on. By the time these four people have shown up, we've already repeated this cycle at least that many times. The people have gone off into idolatry. And then they've begun to suffer. And now they are in mourning, and they regret their decision, so they appeal to God, and God frees them. This goes on all the way through the book, and the time frame of the judges itself, I think, was close to maybe 400 years of Israel's own history, where they repeat this cycle again and again. But more than just a cycle, it might also be a downward spiral. Not only are they continuing to fall into sin, but each time they do it, their moral compass is leading them further and further astray. Some evidence of this might be found in the judges themselves. In the first four judges that we have in chapters 3 and 4, there's not a single bad thing mentioned about any of them. But then you get to chapter 8. In chapters 6 through 8, you have a man named Gideon who was raised up by God to deliver the people from the Midianites. And he's successful in his mission. If you get to chapter 8 and verse 22, the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your son, also your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." Now, is that God's plan?
No.
It's not. Not the plan for a judge. He is to mediate between disputes among the people, or if necessary, to deliver the people from an oppressor, but he is not to be the king. And in verse 23, Gideon tells them, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." That was God's plan. Good for Gideon. But in verse 25, they said, Gideon said to them, "I would request of you that each of you give me an earring from his spoil." So they give him the earrings. And then in verse 27, Gideon made it into an ephod and placed it in his city. Ophrah and all Israel played the harlot with it there, so that it became a snare to Gideon and his household. So Midian was subdued by the sons of Israel, and they did not lift up their heads anymore. The land was undisturbed for 40 years in the days of Gideon. But Gideon fulfilled his mission as a judge, and Gideon even kept some humility. When he was offered by the people to become their king, he recognized that was not his function and not his right, that God was to be the people of Israel. But he ends up making something that becomes essentially an idol for him and for the people. As you go on through the book further, in chapter 9, you have, depending on how you count it, you can count Abimelech as a judge or you don't have to. There's no indication that he was raised up by God. He was an evil and wicked man. And sometimes the chapter itself may be labeled Abimelech the usurper, but he's clearly not a righteous man that is reigning over the people. Then you get to chapter 11 in verse 31. And you have the man Jephthah. And depending on how you interpret this story, I personally don't think that he sacrificed his daughter in fire, but some people do. You may be one of those people, and that's okay. But if you think that he sacrificed his daughter in fire, first of all, was that even okay according to the law of Moses? Did God ever require child sacrifice? No, in fact, he condemned it and expressly forbade it. He said, "I never want this." Gideon, though, is a man of faith. But if you take this to mean that he sacrificed his daughter, this is not an oath that he should have kept. This is not a good thing for this man. So whereas before we meet the judges and not much is said about them apart from how long they may have delivered Israel or what they delivered the people from, what nation, now we're getting some more insight into their character. And then you get to chapter 13. And you meet the godliest judge, right? Samson? I want to be fair to Samson. I think there's some evidence that Samson is in heaven. He's mentioned in Hebrews 11. And boy, does that give me hope. But obviously, he had his faults. And in his case, we may remember his faults more than we remember anything else. He had quite a few talents through the Spirit giving him supernatural strength. But he had a women problem. At least three ladies in his life that shouldn't have been there. His Philistine wife. Was he allowed to take a wife from the Philistines? Who said he couldn't? Yeah, God. Right? Then there was the harlot that you read of briefly in the first part of chapter 16. And then there's a woman named Delilah. Famous one. Everybody assumes that she's beautiful, but the text doesn't tell us what she looked like. Sometimes it's just knowing that you can't have something that makes you want something. And she was a Philistine. He wasn't supposed to have it. Not only that, but as you read through these few chapters about Samson, at times you get the impression that he's not so much concerned about delivering the people and serving God as he is about avenging himself upon his own enemies. I'm not convinced necessarily that that always means that he had a heart full of self-interest, but he just doesn't strike you as, well, he's a far cry from Moses. He's a far cry from other people that the Israelites have had sent to them by God. And if there's anything that we can gather from what we see in the details that were given about the judges, it may be that as the people of Israel repeat this cycle over and over, it just brings the overall character of everybody that lives in it down, even the best of the people, perhaps even the judges themselves. I guess in a way, none of us can ever hope to be more than the products of our own time. And I don't mean to make excuses for bad choices. I don't mean to say that none of us can't take command of our own life and who we turn out to be. But sometimes we are just influenced by the people that were around and the time that we live in. And it may be that the judges were no different. So then he gets to chapter 17. And the last five chapters are the absolute worst. I want to be clear. I don't watch Game of Thrones. I don't want anybody here to think that I watch it. I don't read Game of Thrones. I tried to read the first book, but it just it's pretty filthy. They seem to really celebrate the worst in mankind. That's what you've got in Judges 17 through 21. You've got the worst of mankind. And you've got it in what should be the best of mankind. You've got it in the children of Israel. Look in, for example, chapter 17, in verse 3. You read about a man named Micah. And this story lasts for two chapters, roughly. Chapter 17 and 18. When you read about this man, starting in verse 2, we are introduced to him as he confesses to his mother that he stole from her the 1,100 pieces of silver which were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse in my hearing. Behold, the silver is with me, I took it. And his mother said, blessed be my son by the Lord. Now, if all you had was that, you might think this was a pretty good exchange. Here's a man who, I guess his conscience was bothering him. He goes and fesses up to it, and she forgives him and receives his confession graciously. But then in verse 3, he returned the pieces of silver to his mother, and his mother said, I wholly dedicate the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a graven image and a molten image. Now, therefore, I will return them to you. Anything wrong with that? Ten Commandments, right? It's a bizarre thing because you have a woman and you have a man. They both seem like they're acting from pure hearts that have been framed and molded by God. But then you get to verse 3, and where does this impulse come from? She wants to take the money that's been stolen from her and use it to make an idol. In verse 4, when he returned the silver to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave them to the silversmith who made them into a graven image and a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household idols and consecrated one of his sons that he might become his priest. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Verse 6 is very important. We'll come back to it shortly. You definitely want to remember that statement. You want to remember it because it shows up again at the end of chapter 21. Look in chapter 21 and verse 25. After you go through the five chapters and it just gets worse and worse and worse, the way that the children of Israel sin against God and the way they begin to mistreat one another, we're told again, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. I can tell you this, if you find two phrases like that in a Jewish book like this. If you want to know what that phrase means in particular, you just read everything in between it. So you've got it right here at the end, and then you've got it again in chapter 17 and verse 6. What does that mean? There was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Some people have read that, and they've said that, well, this was actually a good time in Israel because there was nobody there bossing them around and taking their money and sending them off to wars and all this. That is not what it means. That's not what it's about. You read through here, and you'll see what is going on and what the author in particular has in mind. We go back to chapter 17 and the story of Micah. Look down at verse 9. So Micah makes this idol, and he even makes his son to be a priest. And then along comes a Levite. And this Levite, of all people in the nation of Israel, should know what God has required of the people as far as how to worship Him, how to serve Him. Micah said to him in verse 9, "Where do you come from?" He said to him, "I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to stay wherever I may find a place." And Micah said to him, "Dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me. I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, a suit of clothes, and your maintenance." So the Levite went in. And then you find that he agrees to this whole arrangement. He's going to be a priest to this idol because the man has been bought off. Now, from the corruption of the Levite comes corruption of others. And then in chapter 18, we're told again in verse 1, "In those days there was no king in Israel." And that may be telling us that, yes, this was in the time of the judges when there were no kings, and yet it may mean something else altogether. Be that as it may, as you go through the rest of this chapter, you find that this idol provokes bloodshed between the tribe of Dan and the household of Micah. So it becomes a snare to the Levite, to Micah and his household. And it becomes a cause of war. Then you get to chapter 19, and we read about another Levite. Only this one has a concubine. I sure would like to meet somebody that understood God's stance on concubines back in the Old Testament. I just, for the life of me, can't figure that out. For the life of me, I can't figure out why the Israelites had that arrangement. I can understand why other nations had it, I guess. But why the Jews of all people had it, I don't know. But here's a Levite, and he's got a concubine, and they're traveling. If you look in chapter 19 and verse 12, they have a chance to maybe stop in a city full of people that are not Jews. And the Levite tells his servant, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who are not of the sons of Israel, but we will go on as far as Gibeah." That's an interesting statement because it seems to tell you that this man understands that Israel is supposed to be something different. They're not supposed to be like everyone else. And you might at least expect better behavior than he receives from his fellow Jews, but we're shocked yet again. Drop down to verse 22. There's an old man that takes the man and his servant and his concubine in, lets them stay the night with him. And then in verse 22, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows, this city, by the way, is a Jewish city, they surround the house, they pound the door, they speak to the owner, they tell him, "Bring out the man who came into your house that we may have relations with him." Well, what does this recall?
Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah. Sodom and Gomorrah, were they cities of Jews?
No.
No. Were they cities full of people who knew the law and kept it?
No.
No. We might not be so shocked to find what goes on in Sodom and Gomorrah, but this is a Jewish town. Verse 23, the owner of the house says, "No, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly since this man has come into my house. Do not commit this act of folly." If you just stop reading there, you think good for him. But then in verse 24, "Here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. Please let me bring them out that you may ravish them and do to them whatever you wish. Do not commit such an act of folly against them." But the men would not listen. So the man seized his concubine and brought her out to them, and they raped her and abused her all night until morning. They let her go at the approach of dawn. As the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was. until full daylight. But her master arose in the morning and opened the door of the house and went out to go on his way. And behold, his concubine was lying at the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up and let us go." But there was no answer. Then he placed her on the donkey, and the man rose and went to his home. She's been so severely abused that she died. What a terrible way to go. Verse 29, when he entered his house, he took a knife and laid hold of his concubine and cut her in 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. Now we come back to where we started. All who saw it said, "Nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from the day when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day." Consider it, take counsel, and speak up. That's some pretty good advice for the rest of us too, the last thing in verse 30. Consider it, take counsel, and speak up. As you go through the rest of the book, we're not going to read any more from these two chapters, but in chapter 20, Israel makes war on Benjamin, loss of much life, many, many lives taken. And then in chapter 21, there's a problem in that the vengeance exacted on Benjamin has been so severe that there's concern that the tribe of Benjamin might die out. So now their inheritance has to be guaranteed and wives have to be found for the tribe of Benjamin. Then you get down to the very end of the book, chapter 21 and verse 25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And when you read the aftermath, even when you read the story of the Levite and his concubine, and you read the aftermath in the next two chapters, everybody's sense of morality is off. First of all, the man, as far as I can tell, he really shouldn't have had a concubine anyway, even if God did tolerate it. And not only that, but once they take refuge and they go into a city, if you've got men wanting to have sex with a man, you don't try to appease them and let them rape a woman all night long to the point that she dies, and then to desecrate her body in the way that he does, and then for the bloodshed that goes on with Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin decides to protect some of the men that were involved in what happened with the concubine. Why are they doing that? And then it spills out into a bigger and bigger war, and it's so bad that now there's the threat of what's going to happen to Benjamin down the road. Everything is just off. Well, why did it happen? That's the question that people are essentially begging in chapter 19 and verse 30. Nothing like this has ever happened since we came up from the land of Israel. And the reason that we have in the book itself are the two phrases. There was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Well, what does that mean? I think I can understand that a king would keep people in line so that they would not make their decisions based solely on what seems right to them. But what kind of king is in view here? I think that's the real important question. Maybe if we had better rulers in our own day and time, things like you find on the news in Las Vegas with 58 people dead, that may not happen as much. But don't forget, that man had a dead soul. He didn't just lack a fear of the death penalty, he lacked a fear of hell and of God. I guess the question that I would ask as I read through this in the book of Judges is, did the kings of Israel, for the most part, keep the people on the straight and narrow? You know, by my count, there are 40 kings between the north and the south, and only 7 of them were good. That's 21%. Sometimes they had really good kings, like Josiah, who tore down the high places and tore down the altars. But Josiah's reforms, we studied about this when we went through the book of Jeremiah, were they lasting? Were they permanent? No, it was all in the exterior. Who had the job of reforming the hearts of the people? The priests, the prophets like Jeremiah, were they successful?
No.
They were not. In the book of Judges, we read earlier in chapter 8, verse 23, Gideon is offered a throne by the people and he turns it down. He says, I will not rule over you. My sons will not rule over you. Who does he say would or should rule over the people of Israel?
The Lord.
The Lord. That was the intended arrangement. Hold your place in Judges and look in 1 Samuel chapter 8. And verse 7, this is when the people reject the judges. They reject Samuel. They tell Samuel that we want a king like all the other nations. Listen to what the Lord says to Samuel. Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they've rejected who? Me from being what? Ruler or king over them. The intended arrangement was for God to be the sovereign over the people. We think of wanting a king who's going to reign on a throne in Jerusalem, or that's how the Jews may have thought. We want someone like Saul, we want someone like David or Solomon. God was supposed to be the king, but he was going to rule somewhere else. He would rule in the hearts of the people. And he did that through the teaching of the law of Moses. When you go back to Judges chapter 2, there's a summary statement at the beginning of the book that captures the theme of the story. Starts off with a flashback to the time of Joshua, Judges 2 and verse 6. When Joshua had dismissed the people, the sons of Israel went each to his inheritance to possess the land. The people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, who had seen all the great work of the Lord which he had done for Israel. But in verse 8, Joshua dies. Verse 9, he's buried. Verse 10, all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work which he had done for Israel. So then you get to the end of the book and we're told that there was no king in Israel. These two things I think are related. They did not know the Lord. Obviously, that's more than just simply knowing that there was a God or that he exists. They did not understand some things about him. They did not understand him to be judge. They did not understand him to be lawgiver. They did not understand him to be the one that they would be ultimately accountable to. This king was the one who was to reign in their hearts by faith, which was produced by the teaching of his word and his law. And obviously, that word was not passed on from one generation to the other. So there grew up an entire nation of people who had no king. And the result? They did what was right in their own eyes. I have a hard time believing that when the book tells us in Judges that there was no king and there's this moral anarchy that results, that it's talking about people like David, as fine a man as David was. Or Josiah, probably the best king that ever sat on any throne of the Jews. The king that they needed was the one that they'd rejected. The king that they needed was the one they'd forgotten. The king that they needed was the one who told them, thou shalt not. It's a sick irony that good men like Josiah could not produce an abiding righteousness in the hearts of the people, but every single time they got a wicked king, he pulled them down further and further and further. They always had more influence to inspire sin in Israel than any ruler on the throne had to inspire righteousness. So, look in the Gospel of John chapter 18. the cycle of the Israelites, of the judges, the mistake that they made consisted of making decisions solely on the basis of what seemed good to them and not on the basis of what God said. It's the same mistake that Adam and Eve made. And the people of Israel repeated it for 400 years over and over in greater numbers. And it always ended with the same tragic consequences. But we could make application to the land that we live in. We could make application to the United States because in the book of Judges, it's a national context, but we're not going to. Instead, let's just talk about me and you. It may be that we repeat this cycle in our own lives over and over. Not to say that someone who's trying to live for the Lord should expect to be perfect. If that's the case, then none of us would need Jesus. But it may be that we forget the Lord. We go off into a sin repeatedly. It brings about suffering. And then we may straighten up and then go right back into it. Not because we're trying to live right and we stumble, but because we just forget what he said. We stop letting him reign within our heart. In those cases, remember that in the book of Judges, it's not just a cycle, but it's a downward spiral. And the more we repeat that cycle, the greater harm we risk doing to our own conscience. There may come a day where we find ourselves asking, how did this ever happen? How did I ever get to this point? How did I make that decision? We don't want to get there. And we want to break the cycle. So in John chapter 18, just before Jesus goes to the cross, he's before Pilate. And Pilate entered into the praetorium in verse 33. And he summoned him and he said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" In a way, that's basically the main question of all four Gospels. Are you the king of the Jews? Jesus says in verse 34, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me?" Pilate answered, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." Think about what he said there in verse 36. A king like Caesar, if he wants to increase his kingdom, if he wants to have more subjects under his dominion, how does he do it? Does he go and bargain with people? Does he talk to people? Does he reason with people? He conquers them. Does he have to kill people sometimes to make that happen? So maybe he can subdue a people, but he does it by force. Does that mean necessarily that the people he's conquered, does that mean that their hearts or their dispositions have changed toward him? Does that mean all of a sudden they love him and respect him? Does that mean that they would give their life down for him? Was it any different with Nebuchadnezzar? Was it any different with Pharaoh? Was it any different with Alexander the Great? Never been any different with any ruler among men, period. No different even today. The difference is with Jesus. In verse 37, after answering the question to Pilate, he said, basically, "My kingdom doesn't spread like the kingdoms of men. Your boss, Caesar, if he wants more subjects, he takes them by force. I'm not that way." Pilate said, "So you are a king." So he understood Jesus to mean, "Yes, I am a king, but I'm of a different sort." Jesus said, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." And in verse 36, he said, "My kingdom does not expand by the sword." In verse 37, he told Pilate how it does expand. How does it expand in verse 37? Through the word. "Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." So, if we want Jesus to reign within our hearts so that we can avoid the cycle or even break free of it that the nation of Israel went into over and over in the time of the judges, we have to do what they failed to do. They failed to teach people. They failed to learn about God from His own Word so that He would reign in their hearts by faith and govern all their life choices. If we want to avoid that, we have to have our hearts and minds open to the Word so that Jesus can take His rightful place as King within the hearts of His disciples. Then, there will be a king in spiritual Israel, and it will not be said of us that we do solely what is right within our own eyes. We've got just a few minutes left. Any comments? There was a time maybe when people generally had a respect for Bible morality, and that time is passing for sure, and we're reaping the consequences of it now. So are we immune to what goes on around us? Who was it that influenced Israel in the book of Judges to worship idols? The people living around them that they failed to wipe out from the land of Canaan? So if it happens to our friends, if it happens to our neighbors, it can definitely happen to us. Anything else? Well, we definitely have to have faith in what we know. Jesus taught a parable about soil, and He mentioned that I'm going to paraphrase Him, but if you don't take care of what you have, you can lose what you have. Either it's power to take root in the heart, or you can... I've met people that I think, in a sense, have forgotten what they did know that were once, as far as I know, Christians, but it's because they made the mistake that Jeff mentioned. They lost faith in it to begin with, and then through passage of time and in the death of that faith, they don't even recall what they once did know. That's dangerous. That's evidently what the Jews did over and over. And it can happen to any one of us. All right, that's about all the time that we have. Thank you for your attention this morning. Lord willing, Steve will be back. And on Wednesday, we'll pick up with the next study in his series.